You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden, and my guests tonight, civil rights attorney John Burris and Sheriff Carlos Bolanos, really need no introduction. Tonight, I welcome both of these gentlemen for a discussion about inclusiveness in community. With law offices in Oakland, Mr. Burris is known as a civil rights activist and police misconduct lawyer, and is active in the community as he is in the courtroom. San Mateo County Sheriff Carlos Bolanos has previously served as chief of the Redwood City Police Department after serving the cities of Palo Alto and Salinas. He's also active in the Rotary Club of Redwood City and in the Redwood City and San Mateo County communities. Our topics tonight will include the complex relationships that exist between communities, between the various communities and the police that are there to serve them. If you have any questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside the local calling area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. John Burris first appeared on the national stage when he represented Rodney King in a civil rights lawsuit against the LAPD, but he's had quite a number of notable cases locally. Celeste Guap, the mothers of Oscar Grant and Mario Woods, but less known about him is his work with young people and with his supporting a sense of community. Carlos Bolanos has had an exemplary career in law enforcement, but less known as his work within the community. I personally worked with him in supporting the Rotary Club, doing many civic activities that perhaps are a little less known. And I'd like to open the table to discussing those things tonight. But first, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And before we go further, I would like to invite anyone who has an interest in issues really about community, that's all of us, to feel free to call in. And again, those numbers are 415-841-4134. And with that, I'd like to begin with this. John, I'll start with you, because when we first spoke 2 weeks ago, you said something that really inspired me to have this program tonight. You spoke of meeting with and talking to younger people and about forward-looking, and I'd like to give you a chance to really expand on that a little bit.
Well, it is important to me, certainly as a lawyer who had been involved with many, many young people, both in criminal defense work and in my civil rights work, is for them to have an appreciation of themselves, that they have some responsibility to move and take care of themselves, but also to be mindful that there are forces out there that will take them out and move them in ways that they won't have the best life that they can have. And so what I do annually, and I do sponsor a program where it's entitled Men to Boys and Boys to Men, The Way Forward. And my objective there is to bring African-American men together from different disciplines, few lawyers, be respectable, and men of different professions, including police officers and firemen and teachers and all kinds of professions, along with a number of boys, mainly African-American boys, high school age, and talk to them about their future and give them options and let them know, more importantly, that you have to have a plan, and that most kids that I talk to at this early stage want to be professional athletes. And the way I talk to them is, says, that's all good, but what if that doesn't happen? And so I wanted, so I started talking to them about options and try to introduce them to all levels of work, including the business community and finance, and very important, economics, but also trade jobs. I want people to know that everyone doesn't have to go to college, and that you can become a skilled laborer, a skilled tradesman. There's all kinds of jobs. So I really, my concept is for the way forward. And this is to look forward, make your own destiny, prepare yourself for that future. And I firmly believe that it's important for young people to have a sense of direction. They need role models. They need mentors. And I belong to one or more different organizations that have the underpinnings of their survival is the involvement and the movement for young people.
Carlos, I remember watching as the two of you spoke, and I'm now realizing it's been 3 years now, but let's listen to the two of you speak about diversity. And you had some interesting points about outreach, about connecting law enforcement with the community and really connections within the community. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So, you know, we have the Sheriff's Activities League in San Mateo County, and the premise of that program is to really build that relationship between law enforcement and the kids in our communities. I also believe that they are our future, and by working together with the kids in the community, we not only put a face to the law enforcement personnel that they see driving by their community, but they recognize that we are part of the community and that we care. And we try to build that relationship within our community of mutual trust and communication so that when there are issues where law enforcement is necessary, that work gets done in a much better way when we know each other, we respect each other, and we know how to communicate with each other.
You know, let me just say that down through the years, it is important for police officers to interact with communities, particularly young people, because those are the ones that will form the images. And I wrote this book, now it's almost 20 years ago, called Blue versus Black, Let's End the Conflict Between Cops and Minorities. One of the things that was very significant that I saw in cases I've had is that the police interaction with young people, even small children, has a lasting impact upon their perception of the police. And so if the relationship is positive, people will grow up with that kind of attitude. Unfortunately, in many situations in urban communities, that's not necessarily so. And so part of the work that I have to do is to try to get young people and police officers, particularly in the city of Oakland, where I've done most of this work, to understand and appreciate that how you treat the young people will have a lasting impact upon the relationship you're going to have with folks. Putting aside some of the bad things that happen, but the day-in, day-out policing is one that the officers and the community must have a sense that you can trust each other. And if you don't have that, then you're just going to have problems later on because events are going to happen from time to time.
And I agree. I agree with John. And I think that the importance of that, you know, mutual trust that is necessary is also a mutual responsibility. I believe that from a law enforcement perspective, we should and can do a much better job in how people communicate to all members of the community, whether that be youths or adults. In law enforcement, we have a lot of negative interactions. That does not mean that we cannot communicate in a way that treats everyone with the highest level of respect.
You know, you bring up respect and about the way we talk to one another. And one of the things I was thinking about really doesn't necessarily limit itself to the police and dealing with citizens and dealing with the community, but how different communities within our greater community talk to one another, if they talk to one another at all. Not necessarily people of different ethnicities or people of different economic backgrounds, but it may be as simple as Republicans and Democrats, but just how hard it is in today's times to be talking to people you disagree with and how few people really want to have that conversation. In my own life, I had two friends on the phone whose political views could not be more different than mine. And in today's atmosphere, it was really hard listening to them. But I didn't hang up. I did communicate with them. And with that backdrop, here we are sitting today with the two of you whose perspectives, I don't want to say you see the world differently, but you see that from very different angles in the sense that, Carlos, you're a sheriff, you're the highest law enforcement officer in the county. And Mr. Burris, you are a civil rights activist who often picks up the pieces where we have breakdowns in less when you're dealing with less enlightened law enforcement sources than you might get in some place as nice as San Mateo County. And just the fact that you're sitting at opposite ends of the table and talking to one another is kind of unique. How do we get people to do that?
I don't view this as particularly difficult or challenging to have communications with the sheriff or anyone else that has different perspectives in this area of policing. I mean, I got and understand the tribalness that exists in the society. I get that people watch MSNBC and they don't watch Fox or vice versa. That does exist, and there has to be a movement away from that.
Exactly, but how do we get there?
Well, you know, that's a real you have to reach out and be willing to do that. I'm not a sociologist, and I must admit I'm as tribal as anyone else around the areas that I work in, because that's what I do. I mean, I'm really into representing people in police cases and improving the relationship between the police and the community and how the police treat the community in order to get a positive response from the community, recognizing that there are many other issues that exist in a society, many, many others. But I've sort of determined what my lane is, and I work through in that lane, and I do work, you know, to the extent that law enforcement people want to talk to me. There are cases that I do have an opportunity to change the relationship between the police or even change the dynamics of how the police police a particular community. I've been involved in a lot of different cases where I'm more interested in the possibility of preventing this from happening the next time than I am in doing the case I'm involved in, because I can do the case I'm involved in. But the real question is, can I get the other side to communicate and to look and see what the real possibilities are? That often happens, me talking to opposing counsel, and opposing counsel then has to talk to the sheriff and people like the sheriff to get them to appreciate that the issues that have developed in this case, they have control over them. And if you look at those issues and objectively look at them, you may be able to change the relationship ultimately in the long run between the police and the community. Those are things that I see that can be done, but it also requires this. And I think the chief would understand, you have to have more than just us talking amongst ourselves. We have to have the protesters, the people who have something to say, because they don't have the same ability to bring the issue to the forefront than I do. I have a case, so I can do a case. But part of that case, if you have community support around that issue, you can bring about some real change. And so, but at the same time, the protesters have to listen to and talk with the politicians. Because if you just protest and you're not willing to engage in terms of a positive resolution, then you're not moving a social agenda. And I don't participate in discussions like that.
So I think what's missing for me is the ability to get away from our own perspective and really try to look at things from the other side or the other perspective. I agree with Mr. Burris that police need to ensure that we are doing everything we can to build that excellent relationship that we all want to have with the communities that we serve. And we are the ones that are here to serve the community. But that is also a two-way street. In order to have a good relationship, both sides have to be open and willing to listen to each other and to work with each other. And although San Mateo County doesn't really have the urban communities that Mr. Burris speaks of, in many of those communities, you know, the trust and relationship towards the police is not there. And unless both sides are willing to try to bridge that gap and work together, it is more than just a one-sided solution where just the police have to change. I think it's all of us working together. And in terms of the tribalism and how people get so stuck on their own personal views, I believe that it's critical that we can communicate, we can disagree. That's not the issue. It's how do we do it? How do we treat each other with respect and truly listen to what the other side has to say and not just be blinded or so quick to want to convince other people to think the way that we do?
And with that in mind, talking about people that were getting to think more like we do, I should probably invite a prosecutor now and again on the show to join me, because I have a particular viewpoint as a defense attorney. But similarly, the more that we talk, the better that we all understand each other, the better we can work together. Anne from San Francisco, welcome.
Hi.
You're in your legal rights.
Hi. I'm so happy to hear John Buras on this show. You're such a, you've done such crucial work in protecting civil rights. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank
but
you.
I want to talk to you about the fact that, yes, we can talk, but when there's an interaction with the police, it's life and death. It's physical harm. It's costing loss of income when you're incarcerated unfairly. It's costing expenses when your car is impounded. It's costing bail money. It's costing a potential loss of employment. So this is really serious, and there's more to me on the side of the police that's required.
Let me appreciate you, because you're talking to the choir when you singing to the choir when you speak to me. One of my huge.
I'm not trying to teach you.
Okay.
I'm just trying to
right.
get this on the air.
Okay.
No.
Listen, I know personally a situation. The charges were dropped. However, if this person was not able to rally support, get out of jail fast, the person could have lost the job. The car was impounded. There was a fee. And the guy was physically harmed by the officer.
And thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I'll let you take the answer on the air. But let me suggest one thing before my guests have a chance to answer that. Your points are well taken. I don't want to in any way diminish what you're saying. But you also have to include the fact that it's a very difficult time to be a police officer right now. That the police are making decisions which are often life or death within seconds or minutes. And those are being reviewed by people that are spending hours, days, weeks looking them over, breaking them down into very small increments, and second-guessing every piece of it. So, again, it's not entirely one-sided.
I have to disagree with you on what you just said there. Look, the vast majority of police cases are not life and death situations. Their judgment cases are decided. And what Ann is talking about is the routine collateral damage that occurs to a person when they have been improperly stopped, arrested, or even overcharged. It has collateral damage in the sense that they have arrest records, they lose their jobs, they lose their car, any number of things. It is true that there are life and death situations that occur. We have those in shooting cases for the most part. Those are critically important cases. There are different sides to those. I've been in countless numbers of those. I don't always agree with the police officer's conduct, but I understand that there are laws that go to that issue. But the vast majority of cases are not those. The vast majority of the cases are the kind that Ann is talking about. And the problem with it, of course, when the community understands and sees these kinds of cases, it's hard for them to develop a trusting relationship with the police, because the police then has sort of overstepped in many ways and abused their discretion. And that makes it difficult for people to develop and to develop a trust. I agree that you got to develop it, but it's a two-way street, as the chief understands. And there has to be an extension of that effort for the vast majority of community people to appreciate that. And they have to see it indeed and not just talk about it.
Howard, if you can bear with us for just a moment, I want to give Sheriff Spolanos a chance to respond before we take your call.
Well, I think that Ann, whoever you feel was aggrieved, certainly has an opportunity and a right to file a complaint with whatever law enforcement agency you feel performed in an inappropriate manner. There certainly are not enough details for me to make a judgment as to whether the officer involved in your situation took the appropriate action. Many times people are absolutely arrested because they should be arrested. Their vehicles impounded because they were used in the commission of a crime. And then at some point, the district attorney, because there aren't enough witnesses or the victim recants or for a number of reasons, decides not to file charges. Not filing charges is much different than being found innocent of a crime. In order for law enforcement to make an arrest, probable cause must exist. And in the vast, vast majority of cases, that occurs and district attorney makes a decision not to file, it does not mean that the arrestee was innocent in any way.
And sometimes those things are fleshed out with greater information than existed at the time that the officer made a judgment call. And I'm not going to say there aren't bad officers out there, but overwhelmingly, the cases that I work, it's the better information that prevails. It's what we found out really happened after we've sifted through everything. And not necessarily what I see when I first get a case or what the officer sees when they first see it or the DA sees when they first see it really takes some digging on everybody's part to get to the right result. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. My guests tonight are San Mateo County Sheriff Carlos Bolanos and Civil Rights Attorney John Burris. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside the dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And Howard, thank you for being patient with us. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the mentioning of a two-way street or cooperating with each other on sides. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think there is a really large disproportion between these quote-unquote sides. And I think it has to do with the fact that, I mean, officers, I get it, they're under a lot of stress and a lot of threat, but the only time you get to interact with cops in the daytime or at night is when they're suspicious of you. Like, they stop you to ask you questions. You don't know these people. They want to get in your business. It's really creepy. If it weren't a person wearing a uniform and a badge, that sort of attitude would be kind of threatening. And I don't think it matters that if it came from an officer or not. The fact of the matter is that the way that they have to do their jobs in order to stop crime or patrol things is necessarily has to be kind of adversarial and really creepy to strangers. Like, I just don't see how you can make people comfortable with the idea of some rando walking up to you, asking you questions, or touching you, or especially knowing that these people have the ability to put you in a box or put you in the ground if you do something wrong and you don't know it. Thank you.
Howard, thank you for your question. And Sheriff, how do you deal with that? I mean, how do you establish a greater amount of trust? Howard was discussing the discomfort when you've been contacted, when you've been pulled over, or somebody stops you for whatever reason. How do we get to where people are more comfortable with one another?
Well, I think it's handled through through good communication skills. I think when I approached someone, I always said, "Hello, how are you?" I explained to them why I was approaching them. I received the call for service. You were called in as being suspicious. You matched the description of something. Whatever the actual reason was, I communicated to the person, and I did it in a manner and tone that was not threatening, was not demeaning, but tried to speak to the person on an equal level, and while being empathetic of the individual that I was speaking with. Recognizing that in law enforcement, we don't just, you know, drive down the street and just stop and pick someone for no reason. We really can't do that and detain you. We can make a consensual stop, but even that, we don't just stop anybody on the street. There's typically a reason, and I think that the best way to relieve the apprehension that people feel about their law enforcement contacts is by the law enforcement officer taking the time to communicate with that person the reason for the contact or the interaction, whether it's a traffic stop or whatever it is.
You know, but Chief, what you have said is perfect. That's exactly when I talk about policing and how you communicate with people, that's what you're supposed to do. Now, we have seen the data that has come out, and when we've collected data now from Stanford and looking at the data in Oakland, that's not what officers do. We now know that white officers talk to black people differently than they talk to whites. They're not as respectful, as they say. And part of what I have seen in a long history of policing that I've been involved in, the fundamental issue that I see that causes problems is the lack of respect. Because it's that lack of respect when people think they have rights, and they do, but then they get treated in such a way that demonstrate to them that they don't have the kind of respect as a human being that creates the tension. And so, you know, you have to practice this kind of communications on a long run. For example, what we've had, one of the things my big concern is rousting of kids, rousting of African-American men. The cops will stop them, harass them, talk to them, where you going, blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, you know, what you do is you create issues with young people. I've had cases where a young man had been stopped over 20-something times. Now, and he hadn't done anything and never arrested for it, just hassled, looking to search his car. And that's a big issue that I see. The objective is to search that car, and regardless of how the stop took place. So, granted, what you're saying is what ought to be done and how it ought to be done, but unfortunately, isn't done that way for a lot. I can't say the vast majority, because the vast majority of kids don't result in bad stuff, but a lot of them does, and enough of them does that creates this hostility that exists between communities and the police. There are departments who are doing it very well, you know, and I haven't had a lot of cases in your department, but I do know that there are the people who are doing it well, and if you're the training people that speak to an individual the way you do, that's a wonderful and positive thing, and I wish all officers treat people that way, and particularly the minority communities.
Well, thank you, and I think the only thing I would add to what you said is it's also how those young kids, as you mentioned, how do they interact with the police? Haven't actually been on the street as a police officer for many years. I treat everybody with respect, but not everybody treats you with respect as a law enforcement officer. And I think just as I train our officers to treat everybody with dignity and respect, I think we have a responsibility as parents and as members of the community to make sure that our kids know that when law enforcement is there to assist you, and nothing gives anyone the license to treat a law enforcement officer with any less respect than the way you would want to be treated.
Absolutely.
And the only other thing I'll add is, you know, I'm on the radio, but I'm a person of color as well, and you've spoken about African-American youth. I just want to be more inclusive than that and mention that all youth of color probably have the same interactions with law enforcement that you described.
Well, I don't want to limit it because a good significant portion of my practice is Hispanics.
Exactly.
Huge segment all throughout the state. But I will say this, that it's the discretionary activity that creates the problem. And that is when you have the discretion to arrest someone or send them home. What I have seen is white kids get sent home, the colored kids go to jail. And that's that disparity that exists within the criminal justice system on a consistent basis. And because the point of all of this is that the initial contact with the police, and the police have to make that decision as to whether a person gets to go home, sent to their parents, or they go to juvenile home.
I have never seen any data that confirms what you just said.
Before we'll continue this in just a moment, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Teddy will be with you in just a moment, but you are listening to Your Legal Rights, KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco or KALW.org. I'm Jeff Hayden, and my guests tonight are civil rights attorney John Burris and Sheriff Carlos Bolanos. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Teddy from San Francisco, you're in Your Legal Rights. Teddy, are you still with us? It looks like we've lost Teddy. If you can, feel free to call us back and rejoin us. One of the things that we heard spoken of, and I'm going to ask you to keep the answers kind of brief because it looks like we have four calls waiting and they're having a little bit of difficulty getting through.
Okay.
But one of the things we heard spoken of maybe 10 years ago and a little less recently is community-based policing and having people that knew the community better, would walk streets, would know community group members. So when things were out of sorts, there was a better trust between people, better understanding of people. And that doesn't seem to be spoken of very much these days. Does that factor in the solution at all, do you think?
Well, let me just say that I have been involved in departments where community policing has been tried. And in the early stages, 10, 15 years ago, maybe a little bit longer when it first came up, there was a genuine effort. What turned out to be that officers didn't want to go to community policing because they thought that it was not part of the whole step level of getting promotion. And then ultimately, the community policing became turned into kind of drug task force. And it didn't really serve the purpose in which it was designed to improve the relationship. Now, there are more efforts at that now. Sort of a rebirth of it, and it remains to be seen. I think that any kind of situation where the police are genuinely interested in improving the community relations and then meeting with the community is a good thing. And that, where the community has a place to go to talk about the issues that are affecting them, and the police in that community walking that beat or walking that or driving that beat has some sense of it. I'm not so certain that it actually works, but it is positive. A positive step forward, I think.
Carlos, what are your thoughts? Is that part of the answer, community-based policing?
Well, I think community policing is part of the answer, and it's not a program, it's a philosophy. And what it really entails is law enforcement developing a relationship with the community that they serve, solving problems together, not relying entirely on police to solve problems. Community can solve many of their problems themselves. But I think it does work. Anything that builds that relationship opens up those lines of communications and allows us to understand what the community's priorities are relative to law enforcement. I have found to be very successful and very positive.
I can only tell you this is a very important concept because certainly in urban communities, the police need the community and the community needs the police. And to the extent that you have a relationship that is built either through neighborhood community groups or individual police community organizations. It's a positive thing if the police responds to them and treats them in a respective manner. And not just the two officers, three officers who are there, but it's a philosophy, as the chief said, that's rampant throughout the department. Then it can have a positive benefit.
I agree with everything that John just said, and I think that in many of the problems that we see in our country in regards to police and community relations is exactly because law enforcement and the community are not communicating effectively with each other and not treating each other with respect. And when you have law enforcement in a community that consistently treats a community that they serve with disrespect, we can only have the problems that we're seeing.
Right.
Renee from Hayward, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, first I just want to say thank you for having this conversation. I think it's important. But I wanted to address a comment that was made a little bit earlier where We brought up, you know, the part about whether or not the community is respecting the officers and whether or not the officers are respecting the community, and how respect needs to be given in order to be received. And while I understand that on just a societal kind of viewpoint, I think it's a little bit different when you're talking about police officer interaction with individuals in the community that they're policing, because police officers are at work. So on top of having a duty to kind of protect, to serve, and to control crime or do whatever, they also have a professional duty in the way that they behave. And so whether or not the person that they're engaging with is behaving in a way that is rude or, you know, whatever, they have a professional duty to respond differently. So just like when you are at a grocery store, if your customer is being rude, it's not okay for you to be to respond in the same way. So I think it's important to note that. And so, yeah, that's pretty much what I wanted to
say. Actually, let me just say, I think you're totally right here. I don't think the police have a right, and nor should they, ever lose their professionalism for a person in interaction, even if that person is not being respectful to them. The most important tool that an officer has is their voice, and the ability to use that voice to calm a situation down, to de-escalate that situation, even if a person is disrespectful to them, mm-hmm. is the best form of policing you can do. You don't get to be disrespectful just because another person is disrespectful to you. And just because a level of force is used doesn't mean you get to go to the maximum force either. So these are things that police officers are trained. And when they operate and being calm and keeping themselves together, they can do a better job. Because I think that the community itself, even if a person acts out, if the officer is respectful, and over a period of time, when that event is over, that person will respect the police officer for the conduct they engaged in. I've seen that often.
Renee, thank you. I think you made some excellent points, and perhaps I misstated my position. And my position was relative only to the relationship that we want to have. If we want to have a positive relationship, law enforcement needs to treat the residents and the community members with respect at all times. Make no mistake about it. We are here to serve the community. That is our job. My point was that if we want to have a positive working relationship with the community and the law enforcement, the community must also communicate with respect towards our law enforcement officers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I also want to just point out that I'm a woman of color with a black father who had a very negative interaction with the police officer when I was a child. That kind of shaped my, while I was present, that sort of shaped my perspective on like what it is, what a police officer is, how sure. they behave, who they are. I also have a black brother, you know, and black nephews who I worry about that may have interactions with police officers. And I don't think that people in certain communities of color in particular, behave towards police officers without cause, right? Like it's evidence-based responses. Like we've seen on a daily basis. I know you say the way that police are supposed to behave. If that's not the case often in communities of color, and I've witnessed some things that were just completely out of hand at the hands of police officers, you know? And so while they should, while in a perfect world, you know, everyone would treat everyone with respect, I think it's difficult to say that when you're talking about communities of color that are terrorized by police officers, police brutality on a daily basis. And so I actually work in Deep East Oakland with young people. And so I see things firsthand quite often, and I hear stories from them quite often. And it's difficult, you know, when you have that backdrop and then you see a police officer, it's difficult to tell one from another. This might be a good one, but we know that there are so many that are not.
So if you could just imagine if law enforcement took that same perspective that you just mentioned, if law enforcement said they all look the same to me and every one of them is whatever, a criminal, whatever we want to say, can you see how that does not help the relationship on
absolutely.
Either side?
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what happened. Right?
I agree.
Like, let me tell you the problem with it, because I've seen this more often than not. It's what children see. What you saw as a young child is something that burned in your brain. And unless you have something to offset that, and then you don't really recover from that. I've had cases where I was doing a study of young kids whose parent had been killed by the police. And I can tell you, for the first 5-8 years, those young, and generally boys, were traumatized by what had happened to their dads, and many of them hated the police for that period, that time, and so it was difficult trying to get them to be in a position. And you know, you live in an urban environment, so you rightfully should be concerned about you. I have sons and nephews that I'm always concerned about and giving them advice on it. So that's just the world we live in. But also, I also tell people you should not be walking around scared to death either. That people are not out to get you necessarily. So you should be mindful of who you are, but not necessarily walking around in a paranoid state.
Renee, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I hope that we've answered your questions for you. One of the things that we need to keep in mind, whether it's as individuals dealing with the police or police dealing with individuals, is that we're all people. And no matter which side you're dealing with, whether you're the police officer looking out or the individual who's responding to the police, remember that people have human reactions to things. We aren't necessarily going to respond in a perfect fashion as a computer might or your car might. We as humans are subject to our own emotional responses, our own internalization of what's occurred, and you have to allow for that in dealing with people in general. In a moment, I'd like to talk a little bit about how to get the communication going better between police and the public, but before I do, I want to take this call from Taylor in Burlingame. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me on. I wanted to ask the question the young woman before me just asked, but she did a pretty brilliant job of laying that out. But I will say that I am also a woman of color. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana. It's a different relationship with the police out there. But since being in California, I will say I haven't necessarily had overtly negative reaction with police. In fact, a lot of my family works in law enforcement. But as a person of color, I was raised, I think, in the same fashion that a lot of people like me were, not to necessarily fear the police outright and as you say, walk around in a sort of paranoid state, but rather to be cautious, because there are so many stories of things just going horribly, horribly wrong. And in terms of what can we do to get the communication better and get the relationship better, I personally would feel like I would have more respect and less caution in regards to any interaction with a person in uniform if I saw for every negative, obviously every negative, outright negative reaction that happens between a cop and a person of color, if the police force or a general police force will come out and condemn it. So, like the shooting of Philando Castile, where it was, I think everyone saw on tape that he didn't really do anything wrong. If I had seen, you know, an entire police department or just a group of cops coming together as individuals to form a collective, come out and say, you know what, this is the kind of thing we're trying to fight against. This kind of cop is what gives us a bad reputation, and I want you, the general public, to know that we don't stand for this, that we are trying not to do this. He made a bad judgment call, you know, anything like that. But instead, I get from the media and from general responses, even from my own family members who are in law enforcement, that sort of blue wall of silence in which the police, I feel like, are a family, and that's a great thing internally, but I'm not sure if it serves the public well in terms of public discourse around police brutality.
Well, one of the huge issues, and you put your finger on this, and this is the question of accountability, and the willingness to acknowledge when something has gone wrong. And I have been involved in more cases than I can keep track of, and rarely, if ever, has the police acknowledged any wrongdoing. Although I recently was in a case up in Sacramento, what's in the news this past week, where a young boy was shot, when a young man was a 16-year-old, was hit by a car by a police officer, and the department basically says that the officer was wrong. I've had and that's happening probably more so now than it used to, but one of the huge, huge issues that exist is the unwillingness of a law enforcement department to acknowledge obvious wrongdoing. And I know that there's this conflict between the chief of a department or the supporting the police officer because of the unions and people of that nature that are there who are political in their position, the community. Often the police come down on the side of the community. It's left to the public people to fight this out. But the point that you raise is totally, totally correct. It is an issue that I see and have been involved with on an ongoing basis routinely. And it's just something that unless the department is willing to acknowledge mistakes sooner than later, they will not have the trust of the community when crisis occurs.
Taylor, thank you for joining us. And I hope that's answered your questions. Before we move on to George in Oakland, I want to see if Sheriff Bolanos wants to give us his input on that last question. Clearly,
law enforcement doesn't do everything right, and there are mistakes that are made. Oftentimes, we have to go through our own process, just like when a subject is arrested, they have to go through a trial before we determine their guilt or innocence. Oftentimes, we know they're guilty right away, but we have a process to go through, and it's the same thing in cases of police officer misconduct. They deserve the same rights, the same due process, and we have to have all the facts before we can make a determination of whether the officer acted appropriately or not. Oftentimes, they make mistakes, and they're human beings, and mistakes are made, and when that happens, it's up to people in my position to take the appropriate disciplinary action. And this is a legal show, so I'll also add, a lot of times we have city attorneys or county council who ensure that we don't go out and make any public statements, because at the end of the day, it boils down to liability. So it's not quite as simple as it may sound.
I think the sheriff's position is correct. I mean, I will say that's true. I mean, the public really wants some acknowledgement. But I, you know, as a lawyer, I know that there are legal issues involved. The police officers have the Police Officer Bill of Rights. They have rights within the union. And these are all sometimes in conflict with the truth, at the early presentation of the truth. But really happens, though, at the end, is even if you go through all that, you still don't, even if you find that the officer's conduct was improper, it's not communicated to the public so that they then know that the department had looked at this and have determined that the conduct was improper or was wrong, even if it's sustained. And so that's the part that's troubling to individuals, and rightfully so, is that they don't get information at all that the department is holding this person accountable when the evidence is demonstrated that the conduct was wrong. I recognize you got the Police Officer Bill of Rights and all those kind of issues are there, but from the public's point of view, that's what they see.
So one of the things that I can tell you as an attorney who's participated in termination hearings for a police agency, I won't mention the name, is that oftentimes that's the first thing that's put on the table. Do you want to settle the case? Do you want to end this without a lot of litigation? You have to agree to confidentiality. And that enables somebody to pursue their career. That enables them to move forward. It enables the city to move forward. It enables the betterment of the police department by terminating that person or sanctioning them appropriately and then moving forward. And the problem is that that's in direct conflict with the openness that the community seeks. I'll give you a chance to speak, but we have to keep it tight. We have George from Oakland waiting on the phone. So, Sheriff, anything you want to say further?
Just that when somebody is terminated, rarely is that ever kept confidential. When somebody files a complaint with us and the complaint is sustained, not sustained, unfounded, whatever it is, we communicate that back to the citizen. The only thing we don't tell the citizen is what the disciplinary action or corrective action that was taken.
George from Oakland, you're on Your Legal Rights. Welcome.
Yeah, listen, I've heard a lot about the trees in the forest. Let's talk about the forest. 1967, when the McCone Commission, the Kerner Commission came out, they said one thing definitive. Police brutality caused all that millions of dollars of riots in the 60s. Then in the 90s, we had another riot, Rodney King. That cost $3 billion. Okay, now, what happened? They got rid of Daryl Gates in L.A., and they brought in a black police chief, Willie Williams. What did Williams do first? Did he start in the street? No, he started top down. He must have fired 30% of all command to change the policies on the street. He fired them. He told them, get right or get out. That's what it's got to happen. You got to start at the top, because institutional racism is in the top. It's not in the bottom. Okay, it's been there. Okay, now what happened in L.A. the first year Williams was there? The FBI took statistics on shots fired in New York City. 385 shots. How many in Los Angeles under Williams? 40. They shot Diallo. Two cops, three cops shot Diallo in New York that year with 40 shots. And the whole L.A. Police Department didn't shoot but 40 times in the whole year. So that makes a difference when you get the right top cop. Okay, and most of these little towns like Oakland, they get the wrong cop. You got a big contingent of black people in these cities, and you don't have enough command people in minorities. And that's the major problem. You understand? That's the problem, because the racism is coming from the top. It's not coming from the guys in the street. They can do what they want to do as long as the top doesn't discipline them. And after 50 years, let's hooray for Oakland. They have a community autonomous police review board. Later for that internal affair. Later for that don't work. Okay? We got to have more citizen, and that will change. When we have command,
George,
and citizen, it'll change.
George, thank you for joining us. And Sheriff, as a person of color, you're the head of a moderately large department. What about what George was just saying? Does that make a big difference when you have representation in the top command staff?
It absolutely does, but I think it makes a difference to have representation throughout the organization. The people that the community see is not the top brass. They see the officers and or deputy sheriffs who are out in the field, and I think people are much more comfortable communicating with people who look and talk and communicate like they do. So diversity in our law enforcement organizations is critically important, something we all strive for, and it does make a difference. Many of the problems that we've seen in many of the small towns in middle America is when you have a police force that is entirely of one race, policing a community that is of a totally different race. And many of the problems that we've seen, you could almost predict in those communities.
I will say that, in part, what the sheriff has said is true. In my analysis and looking at departments, the culture of a department gets carried on from one generation to the next, and it starts, you know, it can be top down or bottoms up. But the real issue is when you got new patrol officers coming in, how do you train those officers? And do those officers get trained in the right way? And then you have the question of the sergeants holding them accountable, and how are they being held accountable? So I think the issues of accountability is the important point, and it's up to the command staff to set the right kind of structure for the department and to hold people accountable all the way down the line. And I've dealt with L.A. because I had the Rodney King case, and we still have cases in L.A. now. There's no department that's pure on any of these issues, but there are people who make, because you have people involved, but you have to hold people accountable when they screw up. And I'm like you. I don't think internal affairs is a great situation generally. The cases sustained probably less than 4 or 5%. And I think that the review boards is a good way for at least the community to have a chance to make their point in a public forum so they can be heard and hear what the officer has to say as well. So there's a lot of work to be done here, and a lot of it is being done, frankly.
Well, as we reach the end of the hour, I'd like to give each of you a minute or so to sum up if there's anything you'd like to say. We've been talking about predominantly how we can improve the communication and relations and respect between the public and the police. I was hoping we'd take a broader view of the community in general, but things didn't gravitate that way with the calls that we were getting and the like. But again, take about, you know, if you have a moment, you take about a minute to sum up if you would.
Sure. I think I think law enforcement has a tremendous opportunity and responsibility to improve our relationship with the communities that we serve. And we do that by not driving around in our police cars, but by getting out of our cars, by greeting people, communicating with people in as many type of interactions as we can that are not enforcement related. It is a part of our job to have negative contacts. We write people tickets, doesn't make them happy. We arrest people, it doesn't make them happy, doesn't make their loved ones happy. That is a necessary and essential part of our job to keep our community safe. But I think we can continue to work on doing that with ensuring that we treat everyone with the utmost level of respect and dignity.
And Mr. Burris, would you like to take about a minute and sum up?
Yeah, you know, policing is, from my point of view, is a very challenging aspect of the world we live in. I am involved daily, routinely, on countless cases around the state where I see the negative aspect of policing. I don't view all police officers as bad, but I do think that they're not held accountable as much as they should be. I don't think they de-escalate as often as they when they can. And I do think there's racial bias in policing from racial profiling, et cetera. And I do think that people are arrested when they should not be. But at the same time, I also believe that we're a lot better off now than we were. And of my 20-something, 30-plus years practicing in this area, I've seen substantial improvements. I've seen a more willingness to hold officers accountable, but within a department, and a willingness to take a look at these issues, particularly in the area of mentally impaired people. Those are serious questions that we have to deal with, issues of racial profiling we have to deal with. But on balance, I think that there are efforts, and certainly in departments, to try to make some adjustment to these issues and to give due consideration to the community itself.
Thank you both for joining me. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW, FM 91.7 in San Francisco. My guests tonight were Sheriff Carlos Bolanos and civil rights attorney and activist John Burris. I'd like to thank you both for joining us. We will be back next week with Your Legal Rights, and we will also return with our Call a Lawyer feature. Our attorneys will be available to you both on the air and off the air to answer your questions. So I would like to thank you for listening. Thanks to our production assistant, Martin McLean. And at the controls, my friend announcer, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden, and our thanks to you for listening.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.